This podcast is brought to you by the Leaf Wing Center, helping children and families since 1999.
Brought to you by the clinical treatment team at the Leaf Wing Center. This is the Autism Parent Helper Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Leaf Wings Podcast. My name is Manjeet Sidhu, and I am a BCBA with the Leaf Wing Center. And with me here, I have my colleagues.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sivan Salikian. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst at the Leaf Wing Center.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ray Reyes. I'm a BCBA for the Leaf Wing Center.
Greetings, everybody. Manjeet, Sivan, Ray, and everybody listening. This is John Lubbers, and I can't wait to talk about today's topic. It's a very interesting topic on sleep. So guys, our topic today, like I said, was sleep. And it's an issue that we encounter often with our clinical practice. Parents will bring to us concerns about their child, son or daughter, with sleep issues. As we've delved into this topic a little bit for our parents, we have noticed a little bit about what the research says about sleep problems and, of course, autism spectrum disorders. So I don't know, in your experience, guys, have you heard this much clinically? And what are you hearing about this from your families?
Yes, absolutely. Sleep is a really significant issue that a lot of our families deal with. In fact, typically developing preschool age children deal with sleep problems as well. The research shows us that approximately about 25% of typically developing preschool age kids will experience some sleep problems. And these are usually associated with things like bedtime resistance, delay of sleep onset, nighttime awakenings. We've also found that there are three categories of sleep problems, and these have been identified by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, also by the American Psychiatric Association. And these include dysomnias, which comprise of sleep onset delays and nighttime awakenings, parasomnias, which include behaviors involving motor and autonomic activation, night terrors, repetitive rhythmic behaviors, things like that, and also sleep disorders secondary to a physical illness or other psychological disorder. For our purposes, though, most of the literature that we reviewed and in our experience, and I'm sure you would all agree, the focus is really the dysomnias in both typically developing children and children living with autism.
And if Sivan, if I can just interject for a second, for our parents, and I mean, really that a lot of that went over my head as well. Would you say that we could probably describe those things, what they're described in the literature as like co-sleeping? And that is when the child sleeps with the parent, either the parent needs to go to the child's bed or the child goes into the parent's bed, or prolonged sleep onset delay, which they sometimes refer to as SOD, meaning that you put a child to bed and it takes them hours and hours to fall asleep. Or even they talk about frequent and prolonged night wakings. So the child wakes up many times throughout the night and either is awake in their own room or comes over to the parent or parents' room. And then last but not least, probably our least favorite one on our weekends when we're trying to sleep and get rest from parents, that is, from our work week, we refer to as early morning wakings, right? Where our kids get up at 4, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I think you nailed all of them, John. And that's a great question. You know, parents of children with autism, they'll commonly express all these issues related to sleep that you pointed out, resistance going to bed at an appropriate time, difficulties initiating the sleep, exhibiting nighttime or even early morning wakings, like way too early, kind of like what you pointed out, and co-sleeping as well.
Even raising my two, one was easier to teach to sleep on her own and the other was a little more difficult. I think you threw out the statistic, something in the low 20s or the 20%.
For typically developing children, although for children with autism, that figure is way higher. In fact,
higher.
The research shows anywhere between 44 up to 83% in school-age children.
Mm-hmm. I saw that number, 83%. That's huge. So
yeah, that's very high.
So somewhere between one half to three quarters of our kids with autism spectrum disorder have some difficulty with sleep.
Yes,
correct.
That's a significant
high figure, yeah.
And we know that not getting a good amount of sleep can lead to so many other issues, irritability, tantrums, aggression, anxiety even. So getting a good night's sleep is pretty important.
You know, I saw that in the literature as well, Manji, and I found that very interesting. I would have never really kind of connected the dots so much as a clinician. I thought that was something that helped me clinically from a clinical perspective, is that these sleep issues could tie into, they were saying they could tie into self-stimulatory behaviors. So meaning that kids that maybe didn't sleep that well that night were engaging in more self-stimulatory behavior, or like you said, tantrums and all the other
impulsivity.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and it seems logical because it certainly applies to us, you and I and everybody else out there. It seems logical too, that if you were sleepy, you didn't get enough sleep that night before or the previous week's worth of sleep time, that it'd be difficult to pay attention. So any treatment time that were provided on a day that where a child didn't sleep that well, that treatment time could also be affected. So in what I say treatment time, I'm talking about ABA, I'm talking about public school, I'm talking mm-hmm. about speech therapy, occupational therapy, any of the treatments that we provide for our kids on the spectrum, our individuals on the spectrum, those could all be affected likely negatively by mm-hmm. sleep deprivation.
For us who work in the school setting, we often hear a warning from the family like, oh, yeah. my son wasn't able to sleep last night, so he's going to be a little cranky today at school. And more often than not, I mean, it is a pretty accurate warning. I mean, the child will be different that day at school. And for those of us who work in the home setting as well, late in the afternoon, we'll hear the same warning. And lo and behold, it does affect the child very negatively in terms of how they will be responding in the ABA session.
And I'm sure that the parents and caregivers listening out there will also agree that poor sleep quality in children can be taxing on parents as well. It can increase their family stress, you know, the parenting burden. So it could really have a bleed through effect. And that's also kind of worth noting as well.
So how should we talk about our topic today, guys? We reviewed a couple articles. There's one assessment involved in this, and then there's a couple intervention studies. How should we talk about this for our listeners?
So for our listeners, our main goal is to provide as much information and research and strategies, maybe even some interventions that you may find useful, with hopes that this will benefit the issues that you're experiencing with your child or with your loved one. So we do have a great article that we want to dive into a little bit. This article is called An Individualized and Comprehensive Approach to Treating Sleep Problems in Young Children.
And that was published in the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis, right? And it was by Jin Hanley and Bolo. I'm hoping I'm
yes.
not getting the last name wrong. And was that, Savon, that was 2013, right?
Yes, 2013, out of the Western New England University. And the participants included three children between the ages of 7 and 9, all of them boys. And two of them were living with ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder. Okay. All of them utilized parent-based interventions, parent-implemented interventions. So that's worth noting as well.
Got it. And then the other article that we're looking at that we'll talk about in a little bit was the article by McLay, France, Knight, Blampede, and Hasty. And the article was entitled The Effectiveness of Function-Based Interventions to Treat Sleep Problems, Including Unwanted Co-Sleeping in Children with Autism. And just, you know, we are typically very aware of family preference practices. I think it's interesting to point out that part of this article title is including unwanted co-sleeping. And they went on to discuss in their article that there are some families that do want to co-sleep and they don't see it as a problem. So I think the article that we're talking about, this McLay article, as well as the Jin article, both are looking at this problem from the perspective of parents who don't want to engage in co-sleeping. So if you are a listener out there, somebody who co-sleeps and you don't think it's a problem, then really you can kind of gloss over that. The McLay article had 7 and it was based in New Zealand.
New Zealand.
Yes. Yeah. We have one in New Zealand, the other in New England, and I'm probably going to mess those up in our recording. But it had some really interesting information. And then I think both of the articles looked at assessment and they looked at function, right? Mm-hmm. And
yes.
Both really, I think that's, you know, what we've talked about in previous podcasts, that that's important to look at, to assess, first of all. and then to look at the functions that the behaviors serve, and then to base intervention on those functions. So I found both articles really helpful.
Mm-hmm. They were super interesting and helpful. And to the parents that are listening out there, it's really important for us as behavior analysts, and it's really important for an effective intervention to be function-based and to be individualized with any behavioral issue. When we're talking about sleep, there's a lot of different factors at play. There are behavioral factors, there are environmental factors, physical factors, different functions for the challenging behaviors. Maybe social attention is what's contributing to, you know, your child waking up, opening your door and wanting to co-sleep. There might be physical factors, there might be sensory or tangible factors. So these are really important to determine either on your own or preferably with the help of a behavior analyst or other practitioner. And what that will do is help inform the most effective intervention possible for the client, for your child. So what this study used to collect some data, and I actually, both studies use similar approaches. They use sleep diaries and they use infrared nighttime video, and they also used the SAT, or the sleep assessment treatment tool. So maybe we could talk about those a little bit, since these came up in both studies and they were both pretty effective in collecting baseline data and helping to inform the intervention.
Yeah, let's go over the SATT, or the SAT. So basically, it's an open-ended functional assessment interview designed to identify specific sleep problems and other...
Can I interject really quick, Ray?
Just sure, John.
So for our listener out there, the SATT is the Sleep Assessment and Treatment Tool. And it looks like it was developed by Greg Hanley. I'm assuming it's Greg Hanley, GP Hanley. And it looks like it might go back as far as the original version, 2005.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. I'm sorry, Ray. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. So it looks into the environmental variables as well that contribute to sleep problems observed. So it looks into the history of sleep problems, figuring out sleep goals, identifying sleep problems like bedtime routine noncompliance, delayed sleep onset, night awakenings, and early awakenings, description of antecedent conditions.
And it does this in a nice way. It asks good questions.
Yes, it's a very structured interview. I mean, I was looking at it the other day and it's information heavy, and you can really use it to develop a plan, you know, to how to tackle whatever sleep difficulty a loved one may be going through or the family may be going through.
Yeah. So for example, one of the questions, it says, does your child have difficulty going into the bedroom? Or once in bed, does your child have difficulty falling asleep? You know, and it kind of follows up on those questions.
Yes. It identifies the child's current sleep schedule and likely items, events, interactions that appear to help the child fall asleep. So it's also looking into what works to help my child fall asleep and stay asleep. It also identifies topographies or behaviors of possible interfering behaviors. So what they are, how they look like, and all those, and likely reinforcers for those behaviors. And also, which I like here for the SATT, is it offers descriptions of treatment options from which parents can choose from. It's like a menu of possible things to do, which, I mean, if you're treatment planning, it's good to have that in front of you already, so you don't need to do further research, or at least you have already the information to guide your further research if you want to go that route.
So question, guys, when we talk about topographies and interfering behaviors, what are we talking about there? What kind of
From what I'm getting, it can be anything that the child may be doing. It can be doing stereotypical behaviors or listening to music, I guess, in the middle of the night, or playing around with toys, anything that is, I guess, the opposite of being asleep.
Vocalizing, getting out of bed, walking around,
sitting. So basically
engaging in self-stimulatory behaviors that they normally would.
That's why the SATT really wants to have an operational definition of what exactly those behaviors that we're looking into.
Did we see mention of electronics, you know, iPads and those types of things? Or would this kind of focus more on child generated behaviors like self-stimulatory behavior, hand flapping, those kinds of things, talking?
Not necessarily, but when we apply this, let's say in our own practice, I can easily name one client that has those behaviors. And again, you know, we still have to figure out the function of those behaviors, and each one can have their own.
Yeah, I have heard clinically, this is just clinical recounting. I've heard families come to me and say, my son or daughter will get up in the middle of the night, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and start playing video games or get on their iPad or what have you. I thought it was interesting because both articles really looked at these problems behavior analytically. So they assessed them, they intervened on them. There's a whole lot of developing literature that is sort of non-behavior analytic that when we come to the end of our podcast today, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about, but that's where I started to talk about this idea of electronics and what's going on and what I've heard clinically speaking. But it's interesting that they didn't really observe these. And again, one of the articles was 2013. So it was like 7 years ago when they were probably writing this. I don't know if iPads were as prevalent then as they are now, and tablets, I should say.
Tablets in general, I think.
So, okay. These are two fantastic articles.
Right on. So they also used a sleep diary, and this was for parents to document some basic data around sleep time, such as the time that they bid their child goodnight, when the child actually fell asleep, also the amount or number of night awakenings and resumption of sleep, the time of morning awakening, and also any naps during each day or each 24 cycle, because that could play a role with sleep as well.
That's a huge
alter thing. The value of sleep, right? So
it alters the value of sleep. What that means to our parents, if you take a long nap in the middle of the day, going to sleep at night is like less important to our kids as well as to us. I definitely noticed that with my own children. And a lot of times you'll hear your pediatricians recommend, okay, you know, it might be time to stop taking a nap. No more naps. And I forget, that's what around, it varies from child to child with a typically developing kid, but anywhere between what, 1.5 and 3 years old, 4 years old, something like that. When you start fading away from naps, each child is different, but I think logically speaking as well, our kids with ASD, we need to kind of keep that in mind as well.
Right. Absolutely. And even how many naps you're taking throughout the day. I mean, sometimes kids can take one longer nap versus, you know, three shorter naps through the day. You can kind of adjust those things around too.
Yeah. And I guess when we're talking naps too, Manjeet, those little times when we're driving like to and from school or out to something and they sleep in the car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Those count.
Yeah.
Those count. Yeah.
Yeah.
So since these studies both used like a research environment to carry out the interventions, the baseline data, they also used infrared nighttime video, which is basically a high definition camcorder with, you know, infrared illumination. It was placed in kind of a discrete location in each child's bedroom. And what that would do is just record their nighttime behavior. And it would help the parents and the researchers track how many times were they sitting up in the night? You know, how many times were they getting up, walking out of bed? So the purpose of that was mostly to complement the information that was being obtained from the sleep diaries and for the researchers to more precisely measure the sleep interfering behaviors. Mm-hmm. Although not practical, you know, for most intervention settings, it is worth noting that these studies use this method to capture more accurate data, more reliable data.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's more common that in sleep studies, neurotypical and like with adults, a lot of these sleep clinics will use video to evaluate. So it makes sense. Like I think you're saying, Savan, a little bit in this is it may not be super practical for a home-based setting to set up a camera to track, although it is a possibility as well, especially if some really accurate data are needed. But it was an interesting, I found that interesting as well, the camera. And it was an infrared camera, so it would record in the dark.
Yes. So all these methods were used to collect baseline data and to inform treatment. So this was all part of the functional behavior assessment. This was used to help identify what factors were contributing to children's sleep interfering behaviors, their sleep onset delay, And then interventions were formed for each child, all three children.
So one of the things that I noticed that popped out to me, I'll just throw it out there for discussion's sake, if you don't mind, guys. One of the things that I found interesting was with most of the kids, most of the participants in the study, there was the function of attention. Did you notice that?
Yes. In both studies, almost all the participants had social attention as one of their primary functions for engaging in sleep interfering behaviors.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. Not surprising either.
Yes. Yeah. Not surprising. Very intuitive. You know, we would think that. But what that means for our listener is that the child was performing the behavior, whether that be co-sleeping or waking up early or going to bed late or any of those things that would happen for attention and likely parental attention. So I found that really interesting. And then there were a couple others. I think another thing that I found interesting is probably the majority of the participants, and if we added the 7 and the 2, we have a total of 9, the majority of the participants, the sleep problems that each one was experiencing served multiple functions. So in addition to attention, sometimes it was tangible, mm-hmm. like in the case of Billy, one of the participants in McClay. Yeah. Billy performed the behaviors for attention and tangible access to a tangible or a bottle. Same thing with Lucy, attention and maybe bottle as well. That was the nighttime waking behavior, was for access to a bottle as well as attention. Mm-hmm. So I think that was kind of interesting to me. I started to see some pattern there for our kids.
Yeah, and I'm comparing the participants in both studies. And one thing I notice is that for the Jin study, they were older children, like if I'm looking at it right, between 7 and 9 years old.
Right.
In the study, the one with 7 participants were much younger.
2 to 5. Yeah.
2 to 5. That's why we're not seeing the tangible function for a bottle milk for the other
study. So much for the older kids.
Yeah. That was an interesting comparison right there. It's looking at these two groups.
Yeah.
But I agree. It is a lot of attention-based difficulties for sleep behaviors that these two studies have looked into.
A little bit here and there, escape. Didn't see much for any of the other functions there, but it was mostly attention, escape, and access, you know, tangible.
And escape meaning really escape from the bed. You know, they don't want to be in the bed. That's what they mean by escape.
Exactly. So what do you think, guys? Should we talk a little bit about, so we've kind of described the problems a little bit. We've described the 4 basic things. What are the 4 problems for our parents? We talked a little bit about the kids and what they were experiencing. Should we talk a little bit about interventions, or what do you think? Where should we go next with this for our families?
Yeah, that sounds good. So yeah, we could jump into the Jin study a little bit, talk about the individualized interventions.
Can we rewind a little bit here? I think we should bring it up. It was mentioned in one of these studies that most likely families will refer the problem to their pediatrician, to the family doctor.
Right.
But the problem is, quite a good number of doctors really don't get a lot of training when it comes to addressing pediatric sleep disorders or problems.
Right.
And a good majority of them are getting prescription medication for sleep.
Mm-hmm. That's a great...
Just to add to that there, Ray, I read that it's about 5 hours of training.
Yeah.
For addressing sleep problems. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And around 50% of the prescription given are, you know, for young kids, they get prescription medication to fall asleep or help them sleep. Mm-hmm. And about 75% of doctors have recommended over-the-counter sleep aids. So we're looking at a huge number of medication being given to children having sleep difficulties. That's why I guess this study focusing on ABA-based interventions is quite important.
Right. Yeah.
More often than not, those really don't work. And that's what we hear from families working out there in the field that, oh yeah, my child is on Benadryl or melatonin or something else, but it doesn't really work. period. Right.
Thanks for pointing that out, Ray. Yeah, a lot of times, you know, medical doctors will take obviously a medical approach or sometimes a pharmacological approach to addressing these issues. And it's interesting because the parents in both studies reported, some of the parents in both studies reported that their child, the participant, was taking some sort of either medication or supplement to aid in sleep. And towards the end of the studies and that follow-up, most of them were able to taper off, or you know, at the parents' discretion, at the parents' decision, they tapered off.
The medication. Yeah, that is a great point. That really is a great point. Assuming that a lot of us, myself included, try to use medication only as a last resort, I think that it's a very good point, Ray. Thanks for bringing that to the table. That we, you know, definitely, and Manjeet and Sivan, thank you for that, because I would be one of the listeners that would go, well, you know, are there some other approaches? Are there some other ways of getting going about this? So, okay. So
should we get into those approaches?
So yeah, let's get into that.
All right, great. Okay. So we covered assessment. We talked about the participants. Let's talk about some of the individual treatment packages that were created for the three participants in the GIN study. So Walter, one of the participants.
Sivan, can I interrupt really
quick? Yeah, please.
Do you mind if we talk about the interventions sort of globally and then specifics? Okay.
Okay, great.
So our parents kind of have a little bit of an orientation, and so we can kind of provide a little bit of an orientation. One of the interventions in particular in the McClay study was called the systematic fading of parental presence and then planned ignoring. So what that means is they started to remove the parents from the beds or whatever was providing attention, the parents' presence. They started to cut down on the amount of time. And then they also introduced that they, when the child came to the parent in this situation, that the parent would start to kind of ignore or not address the child a little bit, so that they weren't really getting that attentional function as easy. Another thing was something called the grow clock. And this is based on, sound ABA research. The idea being, this is a clock that helps kids discriminate when it's sleep time and when it's wake time. So the clock really served two purposes. And one was to say, okay, the clock indicates this, that is sleep time. And then the clock indicates that, and now it's time to be awake. You don't need to be asleep and in your bed.
And that was a really cool, fun looking clock. It had like a digital image of a sun, during the daytime to signal, hey, it's awake time. It's daytime right now. And then, a moon and stars for nighttime. Some of them had little modifications or customizations where they would kind of have like a countdown of stars to show when it's time to wake up. So that was a pretty neat device that they used, the grow clock. And the logic behind it, I think why they used it in some of these cases was because they found or that the research showed a lot of times children, especially children with ASD, have difficulty figuring out when it's time to go to sleep and when it's time to be awake. So that was kind of a signal to help them differentiate those.
Totally logical, right?
Yeah.
Totally logical. And similar kinds of things that we do are green light, red light, those types of things, school-based indicators like, okay, it's time to be seated, it's time to be out of class, it's quiet time, it's fun time. So this is really just a clear visual.
It's like a visual cue, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So love that. Of course, last but not least is our positive reinforcement, which we really are big advocates of. And it's part of our belief system in ABA that we reinforce the behaviors that we want and that we either don't reinforce or do other things with the behaviors that we don't want. So positive reinforcement being one, and that came in the form of praise and tangibles and all kinds of things. And it was really individualized and should be individualized to what your child enjoys.
Exactly. If the child's goals, the sleep goals were met for the previous night, that positive reinforcement was applied right at wake up time. And if the goals were not met, then it was withheld.
Yeah. For the positive reinforcement treatment, actually, I'm looking at a study. It's specifically just strengthened behaviors, the solo sleeping behaviors. If they did not sleep, if they did not co-sleep, that's when they get the positive reinforcement in the morning.
Did it describe, Ray, what kind of reinforcers were given? Was it?
This said, I'm just going to read off the article directly. It says the contingency was explained to the child verbally and via social story. The morning reward selected for each child was based on the outcome of the FDA. For example, if the child's sleep disturbance was reinforced by social attention was provided for independent sleeping and the like.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So the idea being like, okay, this behavior is serving an attention function. I am getting up in the middle of the night because I want mom or dad's attention, or, you know, one or the other. If I sleep through the night, then I'm going to get mom or dad's or one or the other's attention in the morning based on, contingent on, dependent on my successful sleeping through the night. So I think what's implied in there, and I think what we can logically infer or deduct from it, is that they were function-based. The positive reinforcement was function-based, and it was individualized by child. So mom, dad, caregiver out there in the audience, what that means to you is, you know your sons and daughters best, or the children in your care. If you know that one child likes these types of things, A, B, C, and D, and the other child likes X, Y, and Z, you would use those specific things that they like to make them reinforcers for the sleep behavior. Okay.
Awesome. Another intervention that was used, particularly in the GIN study that we touched on, was the parents providing ample access to desirable activities and items before the bid goodnight. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like a non-contingent reinforcement approach, with the idea being that in order to lower the motivation for sleep interfering behaviors, playing, asking questions, getting up at night, seeking attention, repetitive behaviors, one of the intervention components was to set up a time before sleep in which rich social interaction occurred between the parents and the child, where there was story time, asking and answering questions, access to books, maybe video games. Once the goodnight was bid, though, these were withheld. So the purpose with that was to really pile on all that fun stuff and get that going before the bid goodnight, so that once it's time to sleep, hopefully the motivation to engage in all these behaviors will be a bit lower.
Excellent. Yeah. So we talk a little bit about the specifics, like any specific...
I'm not sure if we've talked about this, but for the sleep onset delay. Mm-hmm. So these are the times when the child is not able to sleep right away. What they did was they adjusted the sleep time.
Right.
So for example, if they send their child to bed at 9 o'clock, but the child does not really fall asleep until 10.
Right.
They bid goodnight around 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
So the child can sleep right away and then move back systematically.
Yeah. And that, Ray, was, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I think I remember, that was when we were talking about where a parent problem would be, or a parent concern would be, well, I put him to bed, but it took him 2 hours to go
exactly,
to sleep.
Exactly. Which really makes sense.
Yeah.
Why send him to bed when they can't sleep? But yes.
And I was looking at another one in particular in the McClay study. The particular participant was Matt. And it says that Matt was typically taken to bed at 7 p.m. So 7 p.m. And again, remember, these are 2 to 5 year olds. So it's not, you know, if you have a 12 year old and you're thinking 7 p.m., that's crazy. But what Matt's parent or parents were experiencing was that he would get up between 5:45 and 6:30 in the morning. So it was a little early. It was an early wake time. It was earlier than worked for their family. So the simple intervention that they gave for Matt, and this is kind of logical, was they pushed back Matt's bedtime 1 hour to 8 p.m. So just little manipulations like that are the things that we see, you know, and those are important kinds of things. They're definitely helpful.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was the same thing with Walter in the GIN study. It says here that it was about an hour before he would fall asleep from the onset of bedtime. And so they just decreased that Walter's bedtime was forwarded by an hour and gradually moving it back by 30 minutes.
Got it. Yeah. Changing the bedtime. Do you recall, Manji, whether one of Walter's problems was getting up too early or not falling asleep right away?
It was not falling asleep right away.
Got it. So that manipulation, just like you were saying, Ray, was to just delay sleep time. And I guess that's logical too, guys. If we, you know, like those of us who like complain about, oh, I go to bed, but it takes me an hour or two to go to sleep. One of the recommendations probably by a sleep specialist talking to us would say, well, you know what? Why don't you delay going to bed by an hour? Instead of going to bed at 10, go to bed at 11 or whatever that time may be. And it's logical. These kinds of things translate down into our children with autism spectrum disorder. So super interesting stuff.
I think in the McClay study, they also utilize social stories, another very common tool used in applied behavior analysis. And, you know, to the parents and caregivers out there, social stories are mini stories with text, with photos and pictures, and they're a way to model desired behavior. And we also use some oral narratives to kind of guide the child through it. Yes. And they're all individualized. They'll include photographs, they'll include text, and it will show the steps of the bedtime routine.
Right.
Expectations around sleep, sleeping independently, rewards or reinforcers that could be earned for following through with the sleep goals. So these were read before bedtime. And general rule of thumb, Gray 2010 recommends social stories should include affirmative language, descriptive language, direct statements, and just general use of positive language. So focus more on the do's, not as much on the don'ts.
Got it. And just a reminder for our listening audience, the McClay study looked at the kids in that study were 2 to 5 years old. So probably why we use social studies. Now, again, based on chronological and developmental age of the individual, social stories may be absolutely appropriate, but certainly very common in 2 to 5 year olds.
Right. And making sure that the social story is designed to engage in the child's interest. If your kid's really into Superman, then maybe your social story can focus, you know, around the character of Superman and sleep time that way.
Yeah.
So they're engaged more.
Yeah. So Superman goes to bed at 10 p.m. and wakes up at 7 a.m. kind of thing and refreshed and all that sort of stuff.
Right. Going through Superman's nightly routine, you know, that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, that's great. And of course, your treatment ABA professional can help you generate those types of things as well.
Another thing to consider is a pre-bedtime cleanup routine. I think this was used in the GIN study. And this actually accomplishes two things. It's a self-help skill, keeps the room clean. That's a valuable skill for all of our kids to have.
For sure.
And it's also, and this was the main point of utilizing this approach, was to make items inaccessible during sleep time to prevent distraction. Researchers were really trying to keep the sleep environment consistent. So if the child were to wake up in the middle of the night, the same conditions in which he or she fell asleep would be present.
So what were they talking about there, Sivan? Was it like, let's get the electronics out of the bedroom or...
I think they were using like a box or a bag, like a designated kind of an area. So that does a few things, right? It signals that, okay, it's time to sleep. It's you know, SD or discriminative stimulus, a signal to indicate to the child, it's time for me to get ready to sleep right now. The other thing that it accomplished is it made those items inaccessible in the event that the child wakes up during the night, the iPad isn't right next to them. You know, or their tablet isn't right next to them. So it kind of made it inaccessible so that the sleep environment stayed consistent from the time that goodnight was bid all the way until waking time. So I thought that was a pretty simple but effective modification that they included in the overall package there.
Yeah, so, and I think for that, just really addressing the environment itself in general will also help address these sleep difficulties. For example, I think for one of those children, the child was listening to music prior to bid goodnight. So what it did was they stopped the music altogether.
And I think they replaced it maybe through white noise or another ambient
noise or nothing.
Yes.
You know, white noise or nothing, just to make, again, along the lines of being consistent. Like
trying to replace sleep dependencies with more appropriate sleep dependencies.
Was a term they used. Yeah. They did address those things.
So a lot of cool and different approaches. Some of them very easy to apply. Other ones, you know, they require some more parent effort, like, you know, the systematic parental fading, the planned ignoring.
Actually, regarding that, it was a tandem, fading of the parental presence and then followed by planned ignoring.
Correct.
However, for one of the children in the McClay study, the parents did not want to do a fading. They just went to planned ignoring.
Mm.
So those are two different treatments. Mm-hmm. Fading plus planned ignoring, mm-hmm. and fading and ignoring only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, I think the child was Harry in the McClay study.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. I'm not recalling the specifics of that. I'm just looking really quickly to see if there were any other things on in terms of there was some tantrum for television at night, and mm-hmm. so that was obviously put on extinction and replaced. But to your point, Manjeet, Sivan, Ray, structure and routine were generally things that were important. And given that, guys, I was trying to think about this for our listener. Of the 9 participants across the 2 different studies, more or less all of them saw improvement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Across all areas of difficulty. So okay. Sleep onset delay, nighttime wakings, even though they did occur occasionally, they were shorter in duration. In some cases, they stopped occurring altogether. There were some additional benefits, like some of the parents decided to taper off some of the supplements and medication. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so there were improvements across the board without getting into too much super detail with all these kiddos.
Take away from that maybe for our parents is have some sense of comfort, parent, caregiver out there, because these are behaviors, mm-hmm. these sleep behaviors, sleep problem behaviors are behaviors that are amenable or susceptible or changeable mm-hmm. with intervention, assessment and intervention. So you don't, like Sivan was mentioning and Ray were mentioning earlier, and Manjeet, you don't necessarily need to go straight to medication as mm-hmm. the treatment. These sleep problems are treatable when you approach them from a good assessment and a good, sound, empirically based, evidence-based, research-based treatment approach. There is room for hope, guys. You can yes. hang on to some hope.
Yes. Absolutely.
And I think for one of these studies, it got quite hard for 2 families to implement the intervention, so they dropped out. So I guess what can we give you folks, parents out there, is it gets harder.
So say that again, Ray. I want to.
The McClay studies, there were two families that dropped out of the study.
Okay.
When it got to the planned ignoring.
Got it. And did they elaborate on why or speculate on why?
Not really, other than they did say that those two families were having a hard time around that phase of the study. It's understandable. I mean, these behavior interventions are never easy. You know, we always tell families it gets far worse before it gets better.
Well, and we see something similar to that as well. So again, we're talking McClay was the 2 to 5 year olds. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they're little ones. These are infants to toddlers, you know, kind of thing. And planned ignoring again is where the parent, when the child comes for attention, the parent has to ignore that. Mm-hmm. That can be difficult for a parent to do.
It can be.
Yeah,
it's easier said than done.
It is. Yes. It is. That's why we're not saying this is easy. No, parents.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Well, there's some effort.
Yeah. And we know that just from having our parents work with, you know, behavior mm-hmm. intervention and things of that nature, things that are not necessarily sleep related. You know, mm-hmm. These types of extinction, planned ignoring mm-hmm. interventions are difficult sometimes. So mm-hmm. a great point. Parent, caregiver, these are not easy. What I was saying earlier about these are things that are changeable. These sleep problems are changeable. Sometimes the steps are not easy though. So, you know, prepare yourself for that as well. Mm-hmm.
And it involves, you know, receiving parent training as well. I know in the GIN study, definitely. In the GIN study, the parents received 2 hours of training. It was involved modeling, role plays, a lot of feedback, a lot of instructions. So they kind of got to practice what they were going to implement. So parent training is important, really important to, you know, get that going for you.
Super. It really is. Given the fact that we're asking parents to do these things that we all have graduate degrees in, you know, parents don't have usually graduate degrees in applied behavior analysis. So it's important for us to kind of assist them with the knowledge there and the techniques and the approaches and all that. And to be honest with you, you know, as behavior analysts, we have to be cheerleaders a little bit.
Yes.
You know, we have to pat our parents on the back and say, you're doing great. This is what you need to do. This is to be expected, you know, keep going at it. Because sometimes parents will get into it and they'll be like, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't expect this. And, you know, oh, this is so hard. What do I do? So we have to definitely be there for them as professionals. Transitioning towards sort of wrapping this up for our parents, were there any of our kids that you recall across the study? Ray, you brought two where the families dropped out. Were there any that did not respond well to the treatment?
From what I've gathered, and please, guys and lady, correct me if I'm wrong, the kids from the GEN study, those kids that did not have co-sleeping as a difficulty, from what I gather, they had good improvements across the board.
Okay. So that those are the kids that don't fall asleep right away, that wake up during the night.
They wake up in the middle of the night. They wake up too early. Yes. As long as there was no co-sleeping involved, they saw gains across the board. Now, for the families with kids that had co-sleeping as a problem, co-sleeping was immediately addressed and there were positive effects immediately. So they were able to fix that.
Yes.
The difficulty was with the other behaviors like night wakings, curtain calls, early wakings. They did not see an across the board, across all children, they didn't see gains.
Interesting.
It's kind of like a mixed bag.
Yes. Yeah. And did they discuss a little bit what their thoughts were, why that was?
They mentioned that it's possible that those behaviors were not happening. Night wakings, early awakenings, increased curtain calls, they were not happening before as much or not happening at all because the parents were with the kids. They were co-sleeping. Mm-hmm. So I guess in ABA terms, we're seeing extinction-induced topographies.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
So that was what the researchers were thinking of, like why more of these behaviors happened once, you know, we started intervention.
Right.
After co-sleeping was addressed.
Got it. Okay. All right. So that was one of the difficulties that
I mean, it is something that we can expect, you know, we did change, you know, the sleeping habits of the child. So I guess what parents can get from this is just work with your provider, your ABA provider, and make sure that those are addressed right after co-sleeping is addressed.
Got it.
Absolutely.
So in a way, like, let's address co-sleeping first, do the McLay study first.
Yeah.
Once co-sleeping is addressed, then jump into the GEN article intervention that were recommended in a way.
Got it.
That's how you can look at it.
So guys, what are our takeaways for our parents listening and caregivers listening to this? What are our takeaways with respect to this? I know I have a few thoughts. I mean, the first thing would be is, you know, my number one takeaway is sleep problems exist. They're pretty common in kids with autism spectrum disorder, individuals with autism spectrum disorder. They show up in a variety of different ways, co-sleeping, like we were just talking about, prolonged sleep onset delay when the kids, you put them in bed and it takes them hours or a long time to go to sleep. Frequent or prolonged night wakings, meaning they get up more than once or twice in the middle of the night, and or they stay up for a long period of time. So therefore, it interrupts everybody else's sleep, or even getting up early in the morning, early being a relative definition, meaning that it's relative to your family practice. If your family is a 7 a.m. wake up time and the individual in your life is waking up at 6:30, maybe not a huge deal. But if your family is it's weekend, we sleep to 10 o'clock because everybody's tired from the week, and you have a child that's waking up at 5, then that could be a little problematic. So that was it. So sleep problems exist. These are what they come as. They're amenable to intervention, and you don't have to immediately go to medication as your first intervention. You do have another option, is a behavior analytic approach. I think the other thing I would say is that the various intervention types, you know, there's some things that we talked about, the clock, the delaying this going to bedtime, and there's a few positive reinforcement, a few other things there. And then I think last but not least is these things are amenable to these treatments. What do you guys, am I missing anything there? What other things should we bring to light?
Thanks, John. I think you basically covered everything that we need to cover. I would just add to the parents out there, to the caregivers, these are all specific problem behaviors, and we need to be able to identify them for sleep intervention to be effective. So consider, or, you know, with the help of your behavior analyst or even on your own, determine what's reinforcing these sleep interfering behaviors. Is it access to your attention? Is it automatic reinforcement? Does it feel good for them to do even when they're on their own? And keep that in mind when you're developing a game plan. Specific strategies should be used. And, you know, these can be applied to specific types of sleep problems. And that's where the functional assessment comes into play. The sleep assessment treatment tool that was developed by Hanley. These could be brought to the attention of your provider. And consider the sleep diary as well. It's a really simple and effective way to record some information on just the basics before you jump into any sort of intervention. Number of naps, actual sleep time, when good night is being bid, what your goals are, and that will help you navigate through the interventions for sleep problems.
Got it. There were some other things that I alluded to earlier that we see in the, you know, what's being discussed now for intervention for neurotypical, non-ASD individuals, in particular adults. They're talking a lot now about drilling down more on sleep routines. You know, I think we can talk about this maybe in the next podcast when we do a follow-up podcast in the future on sleep and additional research on sleep. So I'll leave that for then, but I'm talking about things like sleep facilitators, like white noise, pink noise, cutting out the light and electronic exposure that people hypothesize messes with our circadian rhythms. And so we can go a little deeper into that in the next podcast, but a lot of good things there to take away. Ray, Manjeet, you guys have any final thoughts?
I just wanted to mention, just kind of going back quickly here, there was a participant in the GIN study that was both on melatonin and Benadryl. And by the end of this research study, he was off both.
That's great.
So I just, there's hope out there.
Yeah. Okay.
And lastly, again, you know, like we said earlier, these behavioral ABA-based interventions, I wish we can say they will be easy. More often than not, there's hurdles. You just got to go over, you know, when you're implementing these behavior plans. Research will have shown that as hard as they are now, there is light at the end of that tunnel, you know.
Right.
Exactly.
Just keep at it, stay at it. With support from your ABA professional, you'll see it through.
Okay, fantastic, guys. Well, so we want to thank the listener for listening to the podcast again. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. If you have thoughts or concerns, we will have these notes and everything on the website. If you have suggestions or comments, suggestions for future podcasts, feel free to visit our website, and that address will come up in a couple seconds to suggest topics. Otherwise, we look forward to seeing you again next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
For more insight from the Leaf Wing Center, please visit the Leaf Wing Center website and blog page at leafwingcenter.org. Email us at info@leafwingcenter.org or visit us at your favorite social media outlet. Feel free to submit questions or comments about this or future podcasts, and we will put links to information discussed in today's show on the website. We look forward to next time. Thank you.